Please, Sakina, stay up and join us. I was walking up because I know there'll be so many people who will have questions for these really extraordinary programs, making an enormous difference in very different but similar in the sense of underserved areas on the ground and how you make it happen. So please either feel free to raise your hand, come to a mic. Olivier.
Hi, the comment / questions for Dr. Klass. I just wanted to thank you very much for your presentation. I'm a second year med student with interest in, probably because of Judy a little bit, in pediatrics and social policy. And I was wondering, how did you, I live with 160 other med students, and most of my fellows feel that they already have a lot to do, they already, like, we're just in second year and people feel overwhelmed. They feel that they don't have the time to, you know, take care of everything they should take care of. How did you convince, and how did you scale up this program, like, with those busy people? And we probably can draw a parallel with teachers also who have, like, a lot of responsibility. How do you convince those people to take yet another charge and to bring that to, a scale, like, as big as the states are?
Is this on? Thank you. It's a great question. I actually have a son who's a second year medical student, and I have full sympathy for, you know, how overwhelmed you are. But it is true. This is a program in which we are asking incredibly busy people to take on one more thing. And speaking as a primary care provider, sometimes it feels like you spend your life, you know, that you come in on Wednesday and today the domestic violence people are here to tell you that you should be screening every parent and every child, and you should be doing, you know, and then next week the oral health people are here to talk about, you know, all the things that you're not doing. And so it is hard. I think a couple of things. First of all, people who go into pediatrics, into primary care, into mother-child health, deep down at bottom, most of them are actually motivated by the right reasons. I won't presume to speak for teachers. It's not a field I know, but you know, nobody goes into pediatrics to get rich, or anyone who goes into pediatrics to get rich should be too dumb to pass the entrance exam. But you know, but if you work with the kind of populations I work with, let me put this as bluntly as I can. I'll put it in the first person, but I think it's true for many of the people I work with, that the program works with. You take care of all these really bright-eyed, interesting, curious babies, and you get to know them over the years, and you immunize them, and you weigh them, and you measure their heads, and you treat their diaper rashes, and you watch your patients get to school and hit a wall if you're working in this kind of population, and especially the boys, and especially the minority boys. These kids who you know were bright and curious and interested and beloved, they get to school and something happens, and the desire to do something to change that balance and to change the environment, when the idea that you could send the books home and then the book will be there and be in the bedroom and be in the child's routine, it was not clever merchandising on our part, because we grew as a grassroots organization with people knocking on the door saying we want to do this. And this is me thinking retrospectively, trying to tap into that. Why did people want to do this when they were already so busy? And I think it was this feeling of frustration that we're so busy, and yet here's this kid I've known since he was 2 days old, and I did his newborn visit, and now he's back with a letter from the teacher saying, you know, not learning to read, disruptive in class, probably should be medicated. And so, you know, I think of this works in pediatrics, is the last thing I'll say. I'm kind of revved up. This works in pediatrics in part because for us it's a small, it's like immunization. It's not everybody's favorite metaphor, but it's pediatrician's favorite metaphor. Can I do something small now for every child so that I won't have to treat a certain number of them with some kind of really negative condition? And that's, you know, kind of in our DNA at this point.
Fabulous, thank you. Anyone else? And if you can reach the mic, great. And if not, if you want to just stand up or raise your hand, that's great too. I've got a question then. My question is for you, Sakina, about how you sustain these programs over the years, right? I mean, it's hard to imagine a program threatened by more and worse transition. So tell us something about the sustaining it over time.
Thank you for asking this question. First of all, I think that the program is, so far I have been able to look at funding because people are really, they come and saw our program and they saw the success of it, and so they are funding. So, and every year we have sufficient funding that we provide the program. But how this can be sustainable during this time of horrible situation that right now in Afghanistan is, we are very careful where we go, how we go, and also we are very sensitive to culture and tradition. We all protect ourselves by wearing hijab, and we are also protecting ourselves by not allowing a stranger into the our compound as a result. So we have been that way, we have been sustainable so far, have not been attacked by anybody, even during the Taliban. I had ED school inside Afghanistan, and none of them was attacked by the Taliban. And that's the way we sustain ourselves, because we keep being very cautious how we providing the service and how we are integrating with the community, with different people. So that's, I hope I answer you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, on the back.
You said, Mrs. Sakina, that you were working with the government hand in hand. Is there any, in terms of capacity building, financial and human, is there any aspect of institutionalization of the educational system with the government and the governmental support to institutionalize the education system for the purpose of sustainability?
Thank you. It's a wonderful question. First of all, we do work side by side with the government by giving them like training. For example, we do teacher training. So far, we have trained 16,000 teachers, and all of them are public school teachers. So that is one thing that we are providing them. And also, we try to give them management skill. The government official, we provide for them a management skill that how they run their offices. But we could not accommodate it because they don't give us a funding. The funding that we have, we provide free service for them. But they want more and more, and we could not afford to give them more. And also, we provide for them leadership workshop. And the leadership workshop also, we try to train the member of the parliament, the member of the ministry, different ministry, and give them a leadership workshop to behave, how they be, what kind of leader they should be, and how they should work with their colleagues and the environment that they are working. Institutionalizing is right now the work of AIL has been replicated all over Afghanistan, especially the Women Learning Center and also our teacher training. All over Afghanistan they are following. But we are working on toward that, that to try to see that if we can institutionalize it through with the government. But it takes time. Yes.
Thank you. Last question to Jada.
This is high for me. I'll try to take it up. Thank you for the wonderful presentations. My question will be for Sakina. Are boys allowed to attend the schools that you establish? And if it's only for girls, then are you planning to establish programs, similar programs for boys? That's my
thank
question.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking this question. I was going to tell you the story, but because somebody told me in before prior decision about the boys. One day I was in a car going from one area of Afghanistan toward north, and with my teacher trainer. And I was in the car, and all of a sudden I was stopped by about six or seven young men, like 20 to 19 years old, with the rifle on their shoulder, and they stopped my car. And they said, we want to talk to her. And my bodyguard and my trainer, everybody was lying down on the floor of the car, and I just was, my heart was palpitating, for not for me to be scared of myself, but for my teacher trainer who were with me in the car. My bodyguard asked, what do you want from, they said, we want to talk to her. They asked my name, they requested that I get out of the car. So I told them, yes, I will get out of the car. And I got out of the car. And those boys says, okay, we know where you are going. We follow you every day. It was a form of threat, you know, what was it? And we know what you are doing. How about us? What we should do? I said, what you are asking me to do? At the time, it was about 8 years ago. At the time, we didn't have program for boys. And they told us that we know, since we born, we know how to hold the gun and shoot and kill. Nothing else we know. So what do you think right now we should do? How we survive? You are not working with us, and you constantly go and provide program for women. How about us? And, you know, I was really devastated. I didn't know what to do. I said, I don't know. I didn't have permission from the donor to really say, yes, I will give you a program. I didn't know what to do. They said, okay, we'll let you go, but we will be on the road. Again, we will follow you. And I came to my office. I was scared to death. I really didn't know what to do. My voice was changing. My whole, I was shaking. I was sitting in my office in my desk and thinking, what is, one of my donors called me at the moment that I arrived in the office. And she was asking me about a report. And my voice, she could feel that my voice is not the same as it was before. And she asked me, what's wrong with you? I said, nothing. She insisted. I said, well, today I face this. And she said, go tell them that you will help them. And you know, since that, the 2 days later, I went to the same road. They were on the road. They stand up there, and they were there. So I took them to the mosque. I didn't know what kind of people they were, because they look very ugly. They look very scary. They were all following the hygiene. It was a horrible situation. And I was scared to take them to my center. I said, okay, let's go to the mosque. I will talk to you. And they went there, and I said, okay, in one condition, I will help you. I will provide a class for you if you come every day. You do not be absent. You behave good. This. So I told them some condition. And you know that right now, they are working still with me. They are learning computer. They are learning English. They are in 8th grade. They are wonderful. As a matter of fact, sometimes they are my bodyguard going to different places. That is not, it's unbelievable. Yes, we have program right now for boys and girls, and we have university for boys and girls, and we have preschool for boys and girls, all ages. Yes, we are working with, now the donor is letting me to help with work with the boys, yes.
So I think you know now why I started by saying you're going to have a lunch where you're hearing about these two totally extraordinary programs. So please join me in thanking both Perry Class and Sakina Yakubi, not just for their talk, but much more for these exceptional programs they're running.